Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
You're listening to the FT Money Program from the Investors Chronicle and FT Money.
Hello and welcome to the FT Money Show. In today's program, the latest on the topsy-turvy, upside-down housing market. With mortgage rates rising out of step with base rates, can it still be cheaper to buy than rent? We find out. Investment funds, have any fund managers managed to keep their heads and your money above water in volatile markets? Spanish property, why Brits owning abroad may be due a tax rebate of nearly £20,000 each. And we have some good news and bad news on long-term savings rates. I'm Matthew Vincent from FT Money, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with the help of my colleague from FT Money, Steve Lodge.
Hello.
So let's start then with the money news. This week, Abbey released its latest rent versus buy index, which calculates the cost of paying off a 25-year mortgage compared with renting over the same period. And with mortgage rates rising and thousands of homeowners now considering selling up to go and rent, you'd think that the calculation would be simple. Renting is now the cheaper option. But no, says Abbey. Even assuming a mortgage rate of 6.64% for the whole 25-year term of a mortgage, on average, you'd still be about £10,000 better off buying a home rather than renting. Steve, this surprised me slightly. I thought that with mortgage rates having risen, you know, the differential between buying and renting would be, you know, down to something very, very small.
Mortgage rates have risen, of course, Matthew, although not for existing borrowers who took out the mortgage a long time ago. But you're right, for people buying now, mortgage rates are up, and people coming to remortgage, of course, as we've talked a lot about on this programme. But there are other issues here. Rents have gone up. Whether that is lack of supply or indeed more first-time buyers holding back because of fears of the housing market, the net effect is rents are up, more expensive to rent, at the same time as house prices have started to fall, and clearly there are expectations of further falls in house prices. So in the round, this is the finding. Of course, I mean, the counterview to all this is that would you want to be buying when you expect there to be further falls? I don't think this index takes into account future expectations, of course.
That's true. It's taking a snapshot as well. I think it was earlier in June that the figures were put together. But some of the differentials seem really rather large. I mean, I'm just looking at the figures, and it's saying that east of Scotland apparently is the place where it makes most sense to buy rather than rent. Something like nice.
If you want to live in the east of Scotland,
well, it's a lovely place. You should go there more often. But £90,000 over 25 years is what you'd save by buying rather than renting. And the next biggest saving for buying is south east of England, £60,000. So these are not trifling sums of money.
No, indeed. And, you know, listeners won't need to be told that most people do want to buy at the end of the day. So even if on occasion the index shows that renting is more worthwhile, the reality is the whole decision between renting and buying is such a kind of illiquid thing that people tend to buy much more for lifestyle reasons, as we know. But of course, there are interesting implications here for buy-to-let. I mean, arguably, the story is more interesting from a buy-to-let perspective. If rents are going up and prices are falling, that's contrary to what we've heard about the buy-to-let market being in trouble. That's not bad news, is it? Landlords who are well-financed are getting good and increasing rents from tenants who hopefully are staying there because they can't afford to buy or are uncertain about buying, at the same time as they are seeing, well, the price of their existing properties might be coming down, but it's a classic example of averaging down and the ability to buy other properties that are falling as well and build up their property empires, subject, of course, to having access to funding. And, of course, some of that funding is getting that mortgage borrowing is harder to get now, of course, as we know.
Well, that's the third factor. Rents are going in the right direction for a buy-to-let landlord. Prices are going in the right direction for a first-time buy-to-let landlord, yes, or someone buying in right, yeah, now. But there was that cost of financing. I think Abby worked its figures, yeah, out on 6.64%. But
yes,
some, you know, lots of buy-to-let mortgages would be looking for higher interest rates.
Exactly, and it's access to the borrowing as well. So it's not actually not necessarily just the price. It's the will they lend certain loan-to-values and so on.
Of course, and as we've seen this week, loan-to-values on a whole range of mortgages being lowered.
Yes, indeed.
Yet again, especially if you're looking for a very good rate. Well, thanks very much for that, Steve. And if you'd like to learn more about the economics of buying versus renting, look out for Elaine Moore's article in this week's FT Money, in the Weekend FT on the 28th and 29th of June, and online at ft.com/money. You can also send in your questions for us to answer by emailing us at ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. Still to come in the programme, a possible tax rebate for Britons who've owned property on the costas, and good news and bad news on a savings rate for life. But first, fund investments. Since the start of the year, the performance of many equity funds has been decidedly poor, with just 8% of stock-picking funds reporting a positive return, according to research conducted by Lipper Hindsight. And even cash and bond funds have not been sure bets, with less than a quarter of the 3,500 funds available to retail investors managing to make any money at all. But a select few have managed to produce consistent positive returns of up to 10% and sometimes more. And the broker Killick & Co. believes they have something in common. They all offer exposure to oil, soft commodities and natural resources. So Ellen Kelleher of FT Money spoke to Mick Gilligan, Director of Fund Research at Killick, about the best and worst funds of 2008.
With the price of oil nearing $142 a barrel this week, how has that impacted the performance of some of these funds that offer exposure to oil and other sorts of commodities?
Well, I think a number of the pure energy funds haven't actually benefited as much as you would have thought, given what's been happening in the oil price. And I think one of the reasons is that a lot of the sector heavyweights in the oil sector, i.e. the large integrated companies like BP, Shell, Exxon, so forth, in many cases are suffering because they are struggling to replace the reserves that they need to, and also they don't make as much refining margin because the input costs as a result of higher energy prices mean that their margins are squeezed. But the smaller exploration stocks have done well, so any funds that would be skewed into exploration production stocks and certainly new energy stocks and funds have done particularly well. But I think what has been noticeable year to date has been that commodities clearly has been a very important part of the portfolio and one of the few places that people have been able to make positive headway.
Where would you put your money, if you were going to suggest a few funds that private investors should look at, what would these be?
Well, I think if you just first of all look at the market backdrop, I think the big concern at the moment is inflation, combined with receding growth prospects globally. In that sort of environment, it is very difficult to make money in equities. And so one area that investors, I think, should look at is how they can hedge against that. An obvious way of doing that is to invest in the sources of any potential inflation, and the two big ones being food and energy. So having some exposure to oil funds, energy funds, and having some exposure to agricultural commodities, and also potentially gold. So that would be the areas I would suggest people should have at least some exposure to in their portfolios at this point in time.
Given the run-up in the price of gold, do you think it's still a safe haven that investors should check out it just seems so high now that you wonder whether it's worth it.
I think if you look at the price of gold year on year, it has had a good run up. But in fact, it's kind of sidelined, really, for the last 4 or 5 months. And given the global backdrop, you would have thought gold would have performed much better. It's always a difficult one to try and second guess in terms of supply and demand. But I think just given what the pressures, the amount of supply, money supply we've seen in the last year or so, that would suggest that it's important to have some gold in your portfolio. And just given the stagflation concerns, again, that reinforces the case for having some gold in the portfolio.
And how does inflation, can you sort of go into a bit more detail about the drag effect that puts on funds?
Yeah, I think it very much depends on the type of inflation you have. So if you have inflation that is demand-led, you've got the sort of gentle upward inflation that is an environment where companies can increase their prices, maintain or expand their margins, then that's sort of a pleasant inflation, if you like. But the sort of inflation that is particularly unpleasant is one where you're getting it's pushed up by increasing wages or increasing cost pressures that businesses are not able to pass on to consumers. And that there is a risk of that. That's the sort of inflation that we're seeing coming through. Given that, again, it just reinforces the case to have some exposure to the areas I mentioned, agriculture and energy. But in terms of the impact that's likely to have on funds, it's also brought to the fore the importance of having exposure to hedge funds, absolute return funds that can effectively, if you like, take short positions in the market. In other words, benefit from falling equity prices as well as rising, or just hedge out the impact this is having on equities.
Would you be able to suggest a few funds that have done particularly well since January that investors should consider buying into?
Absolutely. I think if we first of all look at the area, the sources of inflation, one fund that stands out for us is a fund called M&G Global Basics. This is a UK OEIC. It is up around about 10% so far this year. And the big overriding theme of this fund is benefiting from what we're seeing in emerging markets in terms of increased consumption, increased demand for agricultural products and commodities generally, and in terms of increased personal consumption. But what is interesting is that it only invests really in companies listed in developed markets. So it's a lower risk way of playing the emerging market theme. So that would be one that would spring to mind. I think probably the standout performer this year has been the Eclectica Agriculture Fund. So Eclectica being a small London-based boutique, this is a fund that invests in companies that are effectively riding this agflation theme. So they either are companies like Monsanto, where they produce genetically modified crops or chemicals that will enhance yields in crops, or companies that provide agricultural machinery. In the very short term, we might see a pullback there. And in fact, we saw Monsanto come out with good results this week and the share price fell, which I think is just a bit of profit taking. So we might see some short-term weakness, but we think that long-term story is still intact. So Eclectica Agriculture has certainly done well. And another one I'll just pick out is a fund called Bluecrest All Blue, which is a closed-end fund listed in London. It is a series of hedge fund strategies, and at the start of the year, that was trading on a discount of around about 6%. And what we've seen since then is that discount has gone to a premium, and the underlying performance has been very strong. So it's up around 20% year-to-date as well.
That was Ellen Kelleher talking to Mick Gilligan of Killick & Co. And for Ellen's article on the few funds to have produced positive returns this year, including profiles of the top-performing funds, pick up a copy of FT Money with the Weekend FT on the 28th and 29th of June. Coming up, we have good news and bad news on a lifetime savings account. Before that, though, possible tax rebates for owners of property in Spain. This week came news that hundreds of Britons who sold a property in Spain between June 2004 and December 2006 have begun a fight to reclaim tax from the Spanish government. The property owners believe the Spanish authorities charged them 20% too much capital gains tax. Initial estimates put the total amount to be reclaimed at £11,000 per person, totalling an estimated £37 million. But over the last few months, hundreds of Brits have registered average reclaims of more than £19,000 each, totalling more than £86 million. So to find out who's affected and what chance they have of actually getting this money back, Elaine Moore of FT Money spoke to Mark Bodega, director at currency brokers HIFX.
British nationals who sold property in Spain have been told they might be able to reclaim some capital gains tax that they paid to Spanish authorities. Why is this?
Historically, UK citizens and other non-resident EU citizens paid 35% capital gains tax when selling a property in Spain. At the same time, Spanish nationals only paid 15%. In January 2007, the European Commission ruled that the Spanish tax authorities were contravening the European treaty rules on discrimination by charging non-residents 20% more, and Spain in 2007 had to change their tax laws. So now EU citizens, including the Spanish, are charged 18% CGT on their property sales.
So for anybody who thinks that they were overcharged by 20% when they sold property previously, how might they go about reclaiming this?
OK, well, the first thing that's important to point out is who are potentially affected. Any British person who sold a property in Spain between June 2004 and December 2006 could be entitled to make a claim. Now, due to stringent legal restrictions in Spain, anyone who sold a property prior to this has already lost the right to make a claim, as Spanish law dictates that claims must be lodged within 4 years of the date the CGT was paid. For anyone affected, the clock is ticking, and every day hundreds of people are potentially missing out. So it's important that people, if they think they've been affected, put in a claim as soon as possible. Now, how do they do that? The process really is not complicated at all. And if anyone does feel that they have been affected, all people need to do is visit the website that has been set up to help them, which is www.spanishtaxreclaim.co.uk. The site gives people all the information they need to make a claim. Alternatively, they can call up the helpline that's been set up and they can be guided through the process, and any questions they have will be answered. The number is 0845 680 3849.
And how much might people be able to reclaim?
When we originally started the campaign, we thought the average reclaim amount was somewhere in the region of £11,000. However, we're 3 months into this campaign now, and about 400 people have begun the reclaim process, and the average reclaims are actually about £19,000, nearly double what we expected. It's actually also worthwhile to point out that you're not only reclaiming the tax, by law, you're also entitled to 6% interest annually from when you pay the tax until the time you receive the reclaimed money. So this could increase the amount you recover on average by about 25%.
How likely is it that people will get their money back from the Spanish tax authorities?
Again, there have been a number of different cases where the EU has ruled against sovereign governments in regards to tax. Now, obviously, the Spanish government is rejecting all cases being brought before them at the moment. First, the case will need to, there are a number of cases already in process, and they are already with the Spanish tax office. But we expect those claims naturally to be rejected. The next step is to go to the Spanish courts, and again, we believe that the Spanish government will want to reject the claims. However, once they've been through the Spanish courts, the Spanish must then consult the European Court of Justice, and that's when we believe that the cases will be overturned. Time-wise, we're already about a year into the process, and we think it'll be about a year and a half to 2 years further before the first cases are concluded. Once that first case has been concluded, then everybody else's cases will happen far more quickly.
And even though the cases have begun in some instances, British people can still sign up.
Absolutely. Now. And as I said, it's, you know, you've got basically a 4 year deadline from when you actually paid that Spanish capital gains tax. So if anyone does think they've been affected, the sooner they put in a claim, which will cost them nothing, the more likely they are to get the tax back.
That was Elaine Moore of FT Money talking to Mark Bodega of HIFX. And to learn more about tax on property abroad, you can read Elaine's articles on the subject in this week's FT Money in the Weekend FT on the 28th and 29th of June. And finally today, it's good news, bad news on a savings account that guarantees an interest rate for life. Steve, now, this new account, it's not guaranteeing a fixed interest rate, but it is guaranteeing to pay you a certain level, isn't it?
Yes, it's a lifetime tracker in savings. People will understand the concept in mortgages. This is the first one in savings. So it's from Bradford & Bingley, called Rate for Life, and there are three versions, branch-based, online, postal, all paying the same rate. 0.25 over base rate. So currently 5.25. If base rate goes up to, say, 5.25, you're guaranteed to get 5.5. So that's the good news, is that this beats the kind of traditional problem of savings, which is you sign up to a Best Buy account that is Best Buy today, but is tomorrow's dog account, and at worst is completely downgraded and earns a paltry return. So that's the good news. It's a kind of sleep easy option. The bad news is 5.25 is not going to get too many listeners excited at this time.
It's not near the best rates right now.
Not nearly the best, exactly. I mean, traditionally, of course, a guaranteed premium of 0.25 over base would be pretty good, experts say, in the long run of savings. But we're in a different savings world now and for some time to come, it seems. So you can get fixed rates of 7.15. A lot of providers out there, 7, and that's certainty, and that's true certainty, of course. Fixed rates is what it sounds like. Instant access Best Buys, which are obviously subject to downgrading, paying up to about 6.5%. And there are other guarantee or products offering certainty out there. iSave, for example, with the Icelandic bank, currently paying 6.3% on its Easy Access account, and that gives a commitment for its rate to be at least 0.35% over the base rate until 2011. So, frankly, that's as long a guarantee as most people are going to need. So anyone listening to this programme is likely to be the sort of person who is prepared to move their savings around from time to time. The really bad news as well, of course, is in an era of savings competition, if base rates do fall again because we get another economic panic, then this account's guaranteed to fall.
That's true. Yes, it's going to move in either direction. Yeah. You mentioned that its only attraction really is if you want to put a sum of money away and then just not have to worry about it, yeah, and, as you say, sleep easily. Yes. But we've mentioned on this programme before the Investec High Five account, which also saves you the bother of switching because it averages the five best buys
indeed,
in the market?
Indeed. It's a very good example. I mean, it's a return that is updated weekly according to the five best buys as measured by one of their MoneyFacts, the kind of, if you like, their leading independent rate monitor. Latest rate, 6.55%. Fabulous. And if you look over returns over the last year, it's about the same as well. So based on all this fabulous competition we've had since, fabulous savings competition we've had since the credit crisis took hold last summer. Big catch with that account is you need a minimum £25,000 deposit.
Which isn't the case for the Bradford & Bingley lifetime.
The minimum here is £1,000. The only real catch are instant access withdrawals. The only real limit on withdrawals is if you go for the postal version, it's a minimum of £250 to encashments. So there's no real catches with Bradford & Bingley. Oddly, though, Bradford & Bingley is offering this account at the same time as offering one of the leading Best Buy instant access accounts, paying 6.51%. So it really is a case of, you know, you pays your money and takes your choice. Or
exactly. And just finally, what's meant by lifetime? The rest of your natural life? What happens if Bradford & Bingley gets taken over, which is, you know, a possibility?
Well, indeed, I suppose there is. You know, will they always honour this contract? They say they'll honour it if it becomes a closed account. So if they decide 3 months down the line they don't really want to offer this option anymore, it's too expensive, or they just think it's not very appealing, then people who've opened the account will continue to benefit so long as they maintain the account themselves, even if it becomes an old, a closed, an obsolete account. So it is the saver's lifetime that's the key here.
Thanks, Steve. And if you'd like to know more about the Bradford and Bingley Lifetime Savings Account, Steve has made it his deal of the week in FT Money this week with the weekend FT on the 28th and 29th of June. And that's all we've got time for in this week's FT Money show. Remember that you can email your views and your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from Steve.
Goodbye.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.